All right, so at the end of last time, we discussed the von Neumann stability condition, which essentially stated that if we have a finite differencing scheme, as you can see here, the amplification factor, if that obeys this inequality of one plus some finite amount alpha delta t that depends on the time discretization, then the scheme is stable. And so essentially we went through one direction of this proof. I didn't do the other direction, and I'll encourage you to read up on that. That takes a little longer to show, but is not very complicated, but it's also not of great importance here. And so we also had some really good questions on that stability condition. And so I'll make a few remarks now. I sort of added a few remarks to the ones that I had anyways, and I'll sort of address some of that, those good questions in just a minute. So let me essentially start where we stopped last time, and that was with some general remarks on this von Neumann condition. So the first one I wanted to, the first comment I wanted to make is what I've already summarized essentially in words in the last lecture. Namely that essentially the trick here really is that the von Neumann condition moves everything into Fourier space, and it essentially estimates the L2 norm in real space by the by the corresponding L2 norm in Fourier space using a Parseval's identity. And the nice thing in Fourier space is that for these linear systems, everything decouples. So all the modes become independent and are just updated from one time step to the next by this amplification factor G of Xi. And so this is essentially the trick that this von Neumann idea sort of makes use of here. So I just wanted to write this down explicitly. Of the L2 norm of the Fourier transformed grid function U hat n. And so this is the boundedness of the L2 norm of U hat, and it's much easier to show. Since all the difference equations essentially decouple, so while all UJN are coupled, and the difference equations satisfies this update equation. So we had this U hat of Xi of n plus 1 was given by g of xi u hat xi at n. And thus decouples. From all other wave numbers. Okay. And now I just wanted to make another remark on the point that Boris raised last time, which is a very good one. Namely, one can make the following replacement. So instead of 1 plus alpha delta t, one could, so the statement was for 1 plus alpha delta t. And so we can essentially just replace this by e to the alpha delta t. And the theorem still holds. So for the direction that we've shown last time, it's entirely obvious. But for the reverse one, it may not be obvious at first sight. But I did check, and the theorem still holds. And essentially, the reason is the following: namely, if we look at the amplification factor one plus alpha delta t, and essentially we repeat this n times. So we look at n time steps of this and see look at the amplification at some finite time capital t. This becomes one plus alpha t over n to the power of n. And so you recognize that this is in the limit of n going to infinity, meaning that we go to the limit of delta t to zero. This exactly becomes e to the alpha delta t. So if we look at this for some fixed time, capital T greater than zero. So this actually also works. And I'll get back to this in the next context, namely that of exponential growth that we also discussed last time. So as we discussed last time, so the stability bound of G being greater than one allows for exponential growth, as we've also just seen here. And that is in fact obviously desired in some cases. So for example, in the following, so it allows for exponential growth. So for example, if we were looking at the following equation, where we simply set the first derivatives proportional to the solution U itself, so that would give rise to some exponential solutions. And so in this case, we obviously want some scheme that is able to pick up the exponential growth. But then there's other cases in which we actually don't like that. Namely in cases where the analytic, the continuous partial differential equation actually does not allow for exponential growth of modes, for example, in the following case. So, for example, if we look at a very similar equation, we then add some damping term, essentially a diffusion term, epsilon, and then the second spatial derivative of x, and for some, say, epsilon, diffusion constant greater than zero. So here, all modes, so if you do, you can verify that explicitly if you want by plugging in some Fourier mode, you'll see that all modes are damped. So obviously here we don't want the numerical scheme to be able to amplify modes, because in doubt at finite resolution, it could always pick up some noise, some sort of infinitesimal small high frequency modes that result from Randolph error or some other sources. And it could pick those up and exponentially amplify and completely mask the solution. So we may actually want to prevent that. So for example, if you want, you can do the following exercise. You can discretize this equation with central in space operators. So where you have central stencils for the spatial derivatives here, and you take just some first order forward in time, the simplest possible stencil in time. So I won't write it actually down here and do the full exercise. So you can do that to convince yourself, because it takes a few lines at least to write this down. But if you do that, you'll find that this leads to, and you can then do such a von Neumann stability analysis, and you'll find that the amplification factor is given by one smaller than one plus one half a squared, which is the advection speed over the diffusion constant times delta t. And so essentially this is our effect of alpha here. And so just according to the mathematical definition of our stability criterion, the scheme would be stable, but it would allow for amplification of Fourier modes. Although the continuous version of the equations that we are actually interested in doesn't allow for such growth. And so that, since we are always operating at finite resolution, so this is not a problem per se, because if we go to sort of delta t and delta x to zero, this will still in the mathematical sense guarantee convergence. And so mathematically we would be happy with that, or could be happy with that. But practically we always operate with finite resolution. We can never really look at the limit delta t and delta x to zero due to computational constraints. So this is why in practice, one would then try to avoid a discretization like this for this particular equation, and rather look for something that adheres to the properties of, to the amplification properties of the continuous problem. And so this is actually what is called a strict or strong stability. So sort of one more practical approach to stability would be to demand that if you do a Fourier analysis of the continuous problem and say we have some Fourier modes that satisfy the following, so that at time step, at time t plus delta t, at some advanced time step, we have at least, we have some growth of modes according to e to the alpha delta t with respect to the previous time t. If sort of the continuous problem has a property of this, where alpha is to be specified, and obviously it depends on the problem. Then one would demand for stability the discretized version of the problem to obey the exactly analogous amplification behavior, so that the amplification factor of the discrete problem G of Xi would be also e to the alpha delta t for all wave numbers, wave vectors Xi. And so at least at finite resolution, you can then sort of try to prevent some of these Fourier modes from exponentially growing and sort of spoiling your solution. Okay, which means that in such cases, we actually want a stability of this type. Or say if we want a stability of this type, so one example could be motivated by this comment we just made. Then obviously, so this is sort of just a trivial implication. The requirement on and the theorem sharpens one. Okay, and now I just wanted to make a few comments for how to actually make that stability analysis in practice, and then afterwards we'll actually go through one example, and so you'll be asked to also go through examples on the new problem set, and so the following of comments should hopefully help with doing that. So there's due to the sort of decoupling nature of in Fourier space, essentially what one can do instead of essentially analyzing the symbol of the update operator itself, one could also just, due to this decoupling nature, just make the following ansatz and plug them into the equations. So from what we said in one, due to this decoupling nature, it's actually sufficient to show that, or it's essentially just sufficient to consider a single wave number Xi, so we can make the ansatz that our grid function is given by some e to the ixi xj and plug that in to the equation, to the difference equation. And so we'll get, at least in some simple cases, we'll get this amplification factor right away. And that might be actually easier or more straightforward or more intuitive than analyzing the symbol itself. depending on how sort of lengthy it can be, depending on how many of these S plus and S minus operators you actually have in there. In the end, it is essentially equivalent, just sort of one idea. Now there's another question that in practice you'll come across a lot is, again, if we have multi-level schemes, so if we can't write our scheme or if the scheme is not given in a form where UN plus one is given in terms of some update operator working on UN on the state vector at the previous time step, then again, one can use often the previous method actually works well. Oh, sorry, this is actually 5 here. And so for some schemes, that essentially gives you the answer in the fastest and most straightforward way. But sort of more formally, one can rewrite then the multi-level scheme in terms of a vector scheme to bring it in this update form, in which case we'll end up with an amplification matrix. So we can to a scheme that is effectively written as a two-level scheme. So a simple update scheme, UN plus one equals acting on UN, where again we can, so we've essentially seen this before, where we can define some sort of auxiliary variables and then get some sort of new vector version of the scheme. So then if we go to Fourier space, we'll have Fourier transformed variables here, and in our update matrix operator, we'll just plug in e to the ixi, which is the action of these S plus and S minus operators we discussed last time in Fourier space. And so that would be sort of would have the following form. So we would have some matrix elements here. Okay, you had an and so one can now go through essentially the same proof again, just in sort of in matrix version. And so you'll find that if this matrix, this amplification matrix G of Xi, we assume that this has a complete set of eigenvectors, let's call them GL for now, and corresponding eigenvalues. Lambda L. And then essentially we phrase it in a similar way and then suppose that this constants, again, alpha tau greater than zero, such that we have an inequality for these eigenvalues, namely that now these eigenvalues obey a similar stability bound, 1 plus alpha delta t, or e to the power of alpha delta t, then, so for all wave numbers xi and delta t in our convergence regime defined by tau, then one can again, the scheme will be stable. And so this is, you can go again through the same proof of the theorem, make essentially the replacements. Again, the trick is to estimate these L2 norms in real space by the corresponding one in Fourier space, by essentially just writing out the sort of any solution according to the eigenvectors. So I won't do it here because it will take me some time. I've put the sort of modified proof into the notes. So just in case you're interested, you can have a look at that. I think none of this is really surprising, but in practice it can be actually important because you'll encounter these multi-level schemes and sort of more formal way to prove stability here would then be to look at these matrices and at its eigenvalues and show that each of these eigenvalues actually satisfies such a stability bound, such an inequality. Okay, any questions after here?
Yeah, so I have one. So
yeah,
all of this relies on the differential equation being linear. So if yes. You go to nonlinear systems, and I guess that can mean, I mean, so you know, let's think of quasi-linear systems where at least the highest derivative is linear. Does any of this carry over, maybe not as a theorem, but at least as a practical, you know, rule of thumb?
Yes. So yeah, that's a good question. So So in principle, for nonlinear schemes, you can look at some sort of linearized version of the equations if you want, and then these conditions would be sort of something like a necessary condition. But it turns out that for nonlinear systems, so you can go to full nonlinear systems, and there are sort of other theorems in place that would guarantee stability and convergence in those cases. So here, as you may see, we've made use of this linearity property a lot. So for nonlinear systems, there are stability, these strong stability theorems in place, the conditions there to show are total variation diminishing systems. So there are some properties there, so that, for example, the total variation of your discrete functions have to be a monotonically decreasing function of the discretization parameters, for example. So there are other theorems in place there that you can follow and get stability, and so necessary condition for stability, and then therefore also a necessary condition for convergence. But to my knowledge, this is only possible. So such theorems are only possible in 1D. As you go to higher spatial dimensions, things become more complicated because there's no good notion of an equivalent for this total variation diminishing concept. And so to my knowledge, they essentially, they're still, so general theorems are not in place for higher dimensions. And so one always has to look case by case. And so sort of some statements can be made in some specific settings or so, but sort of general theorems are not really available there.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
And so in principle and in practice, if you want to sort of check convergence of your results, essentially what you would do is so-called Richard extrapolation ansatz, where you estimate the error and you compare solutions at different resolution and check whether they show the expected convergence behavior. So this is something that we might discuss in 2 weeks from now if we have time, but I would probably prefer to move on to actually discuss conservation laws and discretization of conservation laws there. But sort of in practice, if you don't have any exact theorems in place, you would sort of try to do a more heuristic approach to convince yourself that the results you get are actually convergent. Okay, any other questions? So if not, I would just go real quick over just one example of how to apply the stability analysis to sort of a simple problem, namely the advection equation in some of its sort of most simple discretization forms. And this will lead us essentially to the so-called CFL condition. So this is kind of a motivation for the next part. So let's look at a discretization of the advection equation in the following way. So theta here is a parameter, which I'll define in a second. So this is essentially a setup to interpolate between different schemes, or say a sort of a more general scheme that for specific choices of theta has certain well-known schemes as limiting cases. So we can sort of rewrite this in this operator form in the following way. So this would be again the identity operator, then we have minus a lambda theta s plus and plus a lambda 1 minus theta s minus, acting on u j n. So this is rewriting the scheme in this operator notation that we introduced, so s plus and s minus thing on u j n. And so lambda here is the ratio of delta t to delta x, and theta is one parameter that we are allowed to vary between 0 and 1, So just a few special cases. So for theta equals zero. So this just corresponds to different ways of discretizing the spatial part. So here we have, so for theta equals zero, we have backward differences in space. For theta equal 1/2, you can sort of convince yourself that we have centered differences. And then for theta equal 1, we have forward differences. And so we can write down the symbol. So we define this as our update operator, where we plug in corresponding operators in Fourier space, corresponding to S plus and S minus. And so would be 1 minus a lambda, 1 minus 2 theta, minus a lambda theta e to the minus ixi, plus a lambda 1 minus theta e to the ixi. And now you can compute the absolute value of this. And so the expression we'll find is the following: 1 minus 2 a lambda, 1 minus cosine xi, so this is unfortunately a little lengthy expressions here. Minus cosine xi. Okay. And so let's assume that our advection speed is, so just to point out a few cases here, let's assume that our advection speed is greater than zero. So if we look at the backward, okay, now let's look at the forward differencing case first. So theta equals 1. So in this case, we have that the amplification factor is given by 1 plus 2a lambda 1 minus cosine xi, 1 plus lambda a. And so this factor here, depending on xi, varies essentially between 0 and 2. So this is sort of smaller, equal than 1 plus 4 a lambda 1 plus lambda a. And so this case is unstable, according to our definition of stability above. So this exceeds 1, and the final factor depends on delta x, unfortunately, and so doesn't fulfill the stability requirement. And you'll find the same thing for the center differences, actually. So you can essentially do the same exercise here. Oops. You'll get a fairly similar expression. But then the interesting thing is for theta equals zero. So for the backward centered, for the backward differencing case, so so-called upwind case, we'll actually find that it is stable under some condition. So this is for alpha lambda 1 again minus cosine xi, and then 1 minus lambda alpha. And so again, this can be replaced by 2 here. Just to maximize this, and then you see that it's actually stable if this factor behind here is greater than 0. So then we'll actually have a bound that is smaller than 1. So if 1 minus lambda alpha is greater than 0, and so this is so-called Courant factor. So when A lambda, which again, just plugging in the definition, so the ratio of delta T to delta X, that is smaller than 1. And this is a special case of the so-called CFL condition, named after Courant, Friedrichs, and Levy. Sort of apply to the special case. We'll discuss this in a second in a little more general setting. And so this number here, z, this combination of advection speed times delta t over delta x, is it's often called the Courant number. And so if this condition is satisfied, so this combination of advection speed times delta t over delta x smaller than 1, then we get a stable scheme for this upwind discretization scheme of the advection equation. So as I said, this is a sort of special case of the CFL condition applied to this specific case. Essentially what brings me to the CFL condition, which is a sort of more general concept. Namely, what these three authors quite a while ago, about 100 years ago, sort of realized is that the a numerical method can only be convergent if what we defined in the first chapter as the domain of dependence of a PDE. So if the numerical scheme, the numerical stencil actually contains that domain of dependence of the continuous problem in the limit that the discretization parameters go to zero. So let me just write this down. And so that is sort of the more general concept. So if the numerical domain, the numerical stencil essentially followed back in time, contains the true domain of dependence of the PDE. And so we showed in the first chapter essentially that for hyperbolic problems that can be estimated fairly simply by simply the fastest signal speed for a system of hyperbolic equations. And this is exactly what leads to this estimate up here. We'll look at this in a little more detail in just a second. as delta t and delta x go to zero. So why that last bit is actually required is something I'll mention in a few minutes as well. So this is, we actually want to look at the original paper. From 1928, which was, I believe, one of the first papers on stability and convergence of numerical schemes in general. And so, just to look at this in the context of the advection equation, what that actually means. And obviously it would look fairly similar for an actual system of hyperbolic equations. So let's see, let's say we have some, again, let's say this is time and here we, this is space. And let's say we have some point xt here, then we know from, by the advection equation that essentially what we have to look at is simply this simply characteristic here that brings us back to the initial data here. So this would be sort of the corresponding x naught or so. And so the actual domain of dependence here would be just this single point. If we just look at the scalar advection equation, if we had a system, then we would have sort of more characteristics to look at. So you may remember this from the first two lectures or so. But let's just work with this one sort of characteristic for now. And so let's say we have a stencil that looks like this. So this would be, for example, sort of centered in space. So if this is xi here. So it would take a forward and backward point to update onto the new time step. And so if we now sort of follow this back in time, right, then all of the grid points that sort of influence, that can potentially influence our point at xt is essentially given by this, or this domain here. So this is our characteristic x equals at, and this is, say, our stencil. And now you can see here that essentially the slope of this domain of determinancy here actually differs from our characteristic. So the numerical domain of dependence here, let's call it dH or so, does actually not contain the actual domain of dependence of the PDE, which is this point here. And so D is not contained in the discretized numerical domain. And so it's kind of obvious that in this case, a scheme cannot converge to the correct solution because a point outside of this numerical domain can influence or will influence the solution at a given point without essentially the numerical scheme noticing this. And so it's obvious that whatever solution the numerical scheme would compute would not converge to the actual solution of the PDE. Now the other case
So Daniel, here it looks like there's a quick fix. I mean, you just change the relationship between delta X and delta P, and you can make the thing go over the characteristic, and then that would still give you a viable centered scheme, right?
Yes, so it is. The point is that it's only a necessary condition for convergence, but it's not a sufficient condition. For example, scale, and you're absolutely right. So we could, for example, say scale. So if we say sort of delta X, so that the ratio of delta T to delta X is actually not constant, but may actually vary. So we could try and fix that, but then it would turn out that for other reasons of stability, it will not work. Especially for these hyperbolic problems. That is a problem. I'll show you in a second, however, for like a parabolic problem, how it actually works there. So there it turns out that you can find a scheme that has something like delta T proportional to delta X squared, and then you can actually make it work. And that also is actually stable and convergent. But it turns out that something like this is problematic for hyperbolic problems.
Interesting. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now let's look at the other case where we make our stencil bigger and fold in the required information, right? So let's look at the same point again and say our characteristic here that goes through it. So this is again our actual, domain of dependence. Okay, and so I don't have to. So now let's say we take a stencil like this. And then obviously you get the idea, right? So the numerical domain of dependence, which would now spread over this entire interval here, would now actually contain the actual domain of dependence of the PDE. And therefore, in principle, the scheme could converge because it simply folds in the information that really determines the value of our solution at this point on the analytic level. Okay, so this is essentially the idea behind the CFL condition applied to such a scalar advection equation. And so for linear hyperbolic systems, things are fairly similar. So let me just write this down real quick. So then you would just look at delta T over delta X, and then we'd have to use the maximum signal speed, meaning the maximum of all the eigenvalues of the system, and then require that to be less equal than one. And then obviously for nonlinear systems, where we just have some flux here, then the CFL condition would essentially mean to take, again, the maximum value, the supremum of all derivatives, essentially of the flux, taking sort of the supremum of over all state vectors U, which would again, it's just the equivalent again of the maximum signal speed in the system, and making sure that those maximum signal speed characteristics essentially are taken into account in the numerical stencil. Okay, right, and also if we use a wider stencil, then the CFL condition is a little less restrictive on the time step. So adding, as you can see here, essentially adding more points here on your stencil actually allows you to take bigger time steps, delta t, so that your effective your effective slope of the domain of determinancy still contains this characteristic. So this is why in general, at least from this point of view, you'd like to take a wider stencil, for example. Now, another interesting case is, as I already quickly mentioned, is parabolic problems. So the diffusion equation, for example. And there we get, for explicit methods, severe constraints. From the CFL condition, since for the heat equation for parabolic problems, usually the domain of dependence for the analytic problem is the entire, so in one spatial dimension it would just be the entire real space, and that's because you have infinite propagation speed. So in contrast to hyperbolic problems, there is no finite signal speed. And so it turns out, and this is actually an example that you'll explore on the third problem set, so I won't say too much here. But it turns actually out that you can take, that there are schemes, explicit schemes you can take. And for example, so if you can find explicit schemes that vary delta t as a function of delta x in such a way that they sort of go to zero quadratically with delta x. So if you sort of devise such a convergence, often this is called like a convergence path. So essentially the scaling between delta t and delta x that you take to converge to your solution, then it turns out that the explicit method captures the domain D in the limit of delta t and delta x going to zero, and simply, so essentially, you can think of this as, if you look again at the slope, let me try to sketch this here. So if you take essentially the slope of your domain of determinancy, so this has essentially slope of delta t over delta x, right? And now, say you refine by a factor of two or so, so delta x goes 1/2 delta x or so, right? Then you just flatten this out, which is essentially what Eric was alluding to a couple of minutes ago. And so here it helps to actually cover the entire domain. So you will just include more and more and more grid points as you go into this limit, but only in the sort of mathematical limit of delta x actually going to zero, you'll cover the entire sort of real space, and so this becomes arbitrarily expensive to compute. So if you want to actually apply this to actual problems, while it's in principle mathematically possible, it will just be very very expensive to evolve, simply because the time step becomes super small. So this is why for these parabolic problems, for the heat equation, for example, one would use an implicit method that couples all grid points xi in an implicit fashion at the next time step. And so you fold in essentially all the information from the entire real space, and so make sure that all the information is sort of taken into account when you update. And so those schemes are unconditionally stable usually. So we can essentially take any delta t, at least formally, and all the information will still be coupled in. And so it contains the actual domain of dependence of the actual PDE. And so this is also something on the new problem set. For those of you who want to explore this, I think I put it as a bonus question at the end. So you'll look at the stability properties of this, but then implementing this numerically is something for those of you who want to explore that can do that on the new problem set. So this is so one example is famous well known example is the Crank-Nicholson method, and this is the one on the problem set as well. Okay, and any questions before I move on? Just wanted to use the last 20 minutes essentially for finishing up this chapter.
Yeah, just a quick one. So mm-hmm. when you have schemes where the scaling of delta t is different from the scaling of delta, I mean, delta t goes like delta x squared, it seems to suggest that you're using the wrong variables, right? That you should redefine your time or redefine your space to make those two things on an equal scaling.
Right. So you're essentially suggesting to use like different variables, like a logarithmic variable or something like that.
Or I'm not sure exactly what I would do, but yeah.
Yeah, I see your point, yes. That would certainly help. The question is then how the equations would look again on the analytic level and how the properties would change and so on. So I think that is certainly something that one can look into case by case. Sure, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, for example, things like that are done for, you know, if you go, for example, to spherical polar coordinates or something like that, you can, you always have the problem that you you're putting a lot of grid points, sort of, for example, in one angular direction that you don't need, like close to the center, right? But then, like far away, you actually want more sort of grid points, both in radial but also in angular direction. And so you can try and sort of redefine those variables, and that's certainly possible in some cases. But sort of this, but this would also, in at least in some cases, you can try and do a coordinate transformation. In some cases, you may have to actually change the equations from the start or so. So there's also approaches there. But then the equations may look very different and may have additional source terms, or so things will change there as well. And then also some of the stability or other properties may change. So yeah, the devil there is also in the details.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything else? If not, I'll try to go fairly quickly over sort of the last two points I wanted to mention, namely diffusion and dispersion, before we actually move on. So I wanted to wrap it up this week, the current chapter, so that we can start after the break with actual conservation laws and discretization of conservation laws, and then look at actual schemes that we use in astrophysical codes to solve those conservation laws. So let me try to give you a brief sort of primer on diffusion and dispersion. So it essentially turns out that stability and accuracy are not the only things that we care about and that we worry about when looking at sort of finite differencing schemes. They also introduce other problems, because we always, as I mentioned earlier, we always work in practice at finite resolution. So we have to live with what we can compute at finite delta T and finite delta X. And so it turns out that at finite resolution, there are other effects that appear in practice that don't spoil formally on the mathematical level stability and convergence, but on the practical level can actually cause problems, and so this is what essentially this diffusion and dispersion is about. These are new phenomena that are introduced on the discrete level at finite resolution. And so let's see how this arises in finite differencing schemes. Okay, let me just skip this here. So let me just try and illustrate this with one example, and I hope we'll still have the time to get to another one, but maybe it'll just be this first example. But in any case, there's more material and notes which you can take a look at. So again, let's look at our advection equation, our sort of simplest model equation for a hyperbolic conservation law on the linear level. And let's look at some discretized version. So let's say we have some discretized version. So we'll actually look at the so-called upwind method. And let's say we have some exact solution to the discretized equations. Let's call it V of x and t. So the example I wanted to show here is using the upwind method. So this is the following. So this is backward centered in space and forward centered in time. So which means that we have ui n plus 1 minus ui n divided by delta t. So I'll just bring this to the other side. So we have ui n, and then we have our Courant factor here, a delta t over delta x, ui n minus ui minus 1 n. And let's say a is greater than 0. And let's say we find an exact solution to this differencing equation. So then we can essentially write this as we have x t plus delta t, we have x and t. Okay, and here we have v of x comma t minus v of x minus delta x comma t. Okay, just by definition, because v is an exact solution. So now we can Taylor expand that, and we'll actually find the partial differential equation that this exact solution to the discretized equations satisfies, which is, and this is the interesting thing, turns out to be different from the original continuous PDE that we started with before discretizing it. And the difference between these two equations is exactly what leads to these new phenomena of dispersion and diffusion that will go away as in the limit of infinite resolution as delta t and delta x go to 0. And so obviously V will then approach a solution to the PDE if stability and so on is given. But at finite resolution, it will actually be the solution to a different PDE that will introduce new effects that are somewhat suppressed by resolution factors, but depending on the exact prefactors and so on, can actually play a role at finite resolution, so that we can actually see those effects in the numerical result that we find. So here I'm just plugging in Taylor expansions of these terms of V at T plus delta T, and then V at X minus delta X. So it's delta X squared Vx, X, X, and then again, plus higher order terms equals 0. And so what we find here is actually, if we just recollect terms, we find again, our advection equation, Vt plus A times Vx, but then we have these error terms on the right-hand side. minus 1 over 6. And then the third derivative here plus delta t squared through a time derivative and higher order terms. So this would actually be the corresponding partial differential equation that the exact solution to the difference equation satisfies. So this would be the PDE for v of x comma t. And it's different. Oops. From the original continuum PDE. And so you see here, we can actually massage these terms a little more. I will not go through the details here, but just to give you the idea, what we already see here right now is that V to first order, so this term here is first order in delta x and first order in delta t. And so V will be a first order approximation to the left hand side, where the right hand side is set to zero. So this is the first order error term on the right hand side that we see here. And so this is not surprising because we know that the upwind method is supposed to be first order accurate in space and time, because we used here the backward difference and forward difference for time. Both are O of delta t and O of delta x respectively. So that is not surprising. But here we've essentially explicitly derived these error terms of the discretized equations. And we can make another interesting observation. If we rewrite this first order error term a little bit, it turns out first order original PDE, and so for second order, we can simply I just want to re-express some of these one can by just differentiating with respect to time and with respect to x, and then plugging in terms, one can re-express the at second order, we just neglect this term up here, and we can then differentiate the equation two times, and then recollect terms, and then we can re-express the second time derivative by the second spatial derivative, and so we can rewrite this as 1/2 a delta x 1 minus a delta t delta x v xx. And again, here we have our Courant number c. And so what you see here is essentially that this is our, if we just call this our diffusion constant, say either nu or epsilon, or whatever you prefer. So you'll see this is actually the advection diffusion equation that I already mentioned above. So, and this diffusion term here on the right hand side will, as you can see, will go away in the limit of infinite resolution. So as delta x goes to zero, but at finite resolution, it introduces this diffusion property. To the numerical solution of the difference equation. And so this is the diffusion, numerical diffusion coefficient. That's what's called numerical diffusion. And so this will actually lead to diffusive processes where I'll show you an example in just a second of how this would look like in practice. So essentially, if you insert for the advection equation, if you just insert essentially sort of a Gaussian or something like that, then the advection equation would sort of the actual PDE would actually just advect that structure with the correct advection speed. But in such a diffusive system where you have a little bit of numerical diffusion, you know, this peak would actually start to broaden and sort of diffuse out. And so you will actually notice at finite time a change in this advection behavior of the initial data. So I'll show you a graph in just a second. So the other the other effect that can be introduced at the discrete level at finite resolution is dispersion. So that different Fourier modes actually travel with different speeds, and actually lead to dispersive phenomena. So this can be seen, for example, again looking at the advection equation and then taking a fairly simple discretization scheme like the so-called Lux-Wendorf scheme, which is second order accurate both in time and space, and it's a two-level scheme as well, so it's a fairly simple to implement. So this is given by delta t, delta x. J plus one, n minus. Plus. Squared delta t. So I won't obviously derive it here, so I'll just write it down here. But you can read up about it, and you'll frequently encounter this in the literature as one example. So the exact form here doesn't really matter. This is just to illustrate this basic behavior. So we are not too much interested in the Lux-Wendorf method by itself. But just following the same recipes as above, assuming we have some exact solution to the difference equations, we can plug that into the difference equation and then again use Taylor expansions to find the actual PDE that that solution corresponds to. So, and then you can do the same thing looking at it by order, and then re-express time derivatives by spatial derivatives. And then in this case, you'll find something that looks like this, delta t over delta x squared. And so here we have the third spatial derivative. And so again, here we see that the first error term here essentially scales as delta x squared, so which is not surprising because we know again that the Lux-Wendorf method by construction is second order accurate. But again, at finite resolution, we have this term here on the right-hand side. And so this leads to dispersive behavior. So if you do something like a von Neumann analysis with this scheme, for example, so you plug in Fourier modes, what you will find, so unfortunately I don't have the time anymore to do it here, but you can read it up on in the notes. So if I were to plug in Fourier modes here, I would find that the propagation speed now depends on the wave vector, on the wave vector xi, so that different Fourier modes travel at different speeds. And in particular, the high wave vector modes, so it, you'll actually find that the speed scales with xi squared. So especially the high spatial wave numbers will propagate faster than the slower ones. And so this will lead to the effect that something like a Gaussian peak will actually have high frequency sort of tail, will get some sort of high frequency tails as these modes sort of move out of the move out of that peak. And so in general, so these are just sort of two quick examples that sort of exemplify these two phenomena of diffusion and dispersion. In general, every scheme, or say some arbitrary scheme, will have a combination of both. So it could be more complicated. There might be error terms here on the right-hand side that have both even and odd sort of numbers of orders of spatial derivatives. So it turns out that the even numbers always correspond to diffusive terms. So they will lead to exponential growth or exponential damping of modes, while the odd orders of spatial derivatives on the right-hand side will lead to dispersive phenomena, so to different wave speeds. And so in general, you can have both both error terms, and they could even be at similar order. And so depending on what your spatial resolution really is, and depending on your prefactors, both phenomena might be present at the same time to sort of a similar to a similar level, and you may actually see that in your numerical solution, which is what I just wanted to show you here real quick. So there's actually a nice plot here in Levesque's book on finite differencing methods that I found, where he shows essentially some examples of doing this. So essentially what he does here is looking at the advection equation as we did here, and he sort of sets up some initial data that are shown here in the upper left. So this is the initial data here, and so this initial data is essentially two Gaussian peaks that have a different width, right? So a sharper one and a broader one. And he discretizes this, and you see all the sort of the points. So this is the initially discretized data at some given resolution delta x. So you see that obviously the sharper peak has less is resolved by less grid points than this broader peak. And so then he evolves this with different methods, some of which we've discussed here, for example, the Lax-Wendorf here and the upwind. And so if you evolve this now, and so he evolved this for sort of a certain number of time steps. And so essentially that these peaks would be advected with the advection speed of the equation. And so then you can take the solution at some evolved time t and then put it on top of the original data again and compare how those changed. And in a perfect world, right, you would, both of them would still agree because the advection equation will just advect the solution. But here you see these finite resolution effects at play. So if you look at the upwind method here, for example, you clearly see how on the one hand, the upwind method is dissipative. So G of psi is actually stricter, smaller than one. So first of all, you have dissipation, so which is why you'll see that the amplitudes of these modes actually of these peaks, actually decrease over time. But then also you'll see that they broaden. And this is exactly, so this is the diffusion, the consequence of this diffusion at finite resolution. And then here for Lax-Wendroff, and also you see that obviously the diffusive behavior is sort of more prominent here for the smaller, for the sort of sharper peak than for the broader peak, because essentially you're resolving this with less grid points, or your delta X corresponding to the scale that you're interested in is actually much smaller here than for the sort of broader peak. And this is why these diffusion phenomena and also the dissipation here is more pronounced for that peak, sort of course, in comparison to the other one. And so for the Lax-Wendroff, you'll see that still after some time, the second peak here actually still looks fairly nice, but then you see how dispersion is here at play. At the first peak, again, because we only have a few grid points, so there's only a sort of a smaller set of, so you'll need higher frequency for Fourier modes here to resolve that peak. And so there the propagation speed scales, as I said, as the wave vector squared. So what you'll see is here that these high spatial frequency modes sort of disperse out of the peak and create these sort of oscillatory behavior here. And less so for the broader peak, where you don't need as high frequency modes to actually resolve it. So this, at least at this time, this time step, at this evolved finite time t, still remains fairly nicely resolved and advected over that time period. And you can look at even other schemes, something we didn't discuss here, Leapfrog, for example, that has even stronger sort of dispersion behavior, as you'll see here. So, and this is why you can see that since we are always dealing at finite resolution, these effects really matter, although mathematically they still guarantee a sort of convergence in a sense, but obviously we want to be as accurate as possible at a given finite resolution, and so minimizing these sort of deficiencies of schemes is therefore sort of very important in practice. Okay, I think I should stop here since time is up. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, I can't resist one, because from your calculation, it looked like the fix to all of this for both schemes was to set the Courant number precisely equal to 1, and that would put you on the marginal stability case. But would that work?
Yes, that is a really good point. So for the diffusion equation, so if I set the CFL condition to exactly 1, then the numerical diffusion would go away. So let me see. Sorry, where did I write this down? Here somewhere. Yes, here. And exactly. So here, if I set C equal to 1, then obviously this term vanishes, and so there would not be any diffusion. But that would be sort of marginally stable, which means that still tiny imperfections could in principle still cause some departure from convergence. So in practice, one would always try to not go to the limit. But mathematically, you are absolutely right that if the Courant factor here is 1, then that would be the cure to this problem here. But then you'd have higher order, other higher order terms that could kick in. So one would have to work out essentially the prefactors of those to see how important they are and whether they would actually appear in practice.
Right. So I guess my question was, suppose that you attempted to minimize the effect, at leading order like this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you would have to be, on the cusp of turning unstable.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which sounds bad, but, you know, I'm not sure what an experiment would reveal. So what would be the worst problem? That it goes unstable if, you know, if you're a little bit too much, you know, if you're a little bit too close to one, or that you generate, you know, dispersion or diffusion.
Right. Yes. So I think probably without actually having done this explicit experiment, but usually you would try not to go to the limit, because, as I said, so little imperfections can turn it one way or the other.
Right.
So the problem here is especially that if you would go to the diffusive case for where C is smaller than one, then you would just get some diffusion. But if you'd go into the other direction where C becomes greater than one, only a tiny bit greater than one, by, you know, round off errors or whatever, then the problem would be ill-posed, because you would have something like a backward directed diffusion equation, where I believe essentially all modes would grow exponentially. And so I think you would definitely want to avoid that. But certainly going close to one, so if you choose C close to one, so very close to one, but not exactly one, you would still be in the diffusive regime, and you would, to a large extent, at least to order unity, again, try to suppress that first error term, because this difference would be sort of fairly close to zero in a sense. So at least right. You would gain a little bit and reduce diffusion a little bit. Here would certainly be, the recommendation would certainly be to choose C as high as possible, but probably not exactly one.
So is it, so as far as you know, is it an accident that we're getting, you know, in both cases, you know, a minimization of the effect when C is equal to one?
I think that, I believe that is an accident here. Okay. So that's just by chance. There's, at least to my knowledge, there's no deeper meaning here.
Okay.
So that could have been something else. So, I mean, this, yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, these combinations here anyways happen to appear here in the advection equation a lot. So these Courant factors are essentially everywhere. depending on how you exactly discretize it, but here it's really just by chance. I believe in general these coefficients can look very different.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I was a little bit taken away by that.
Yeah. But yeah, that's an interesting observation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, there's actually if people are interested in sort of more details, there's obviously more rigorous way to sort of derive this diffusion and dispersive effects for sort of general equations, not just for the advection equation, obviously. So I have a small section in the notes where this sort of more general ansatz is described. So in case people are interested in this, can have a look there. But for now, this is all we essentially need. I just wanted to make the point here that at finite resolution, there's also other effects that that can sometimes spoil your numerical result, and one has to be aware of those. Try to minimize those, or try to find schemes that at least for the time range that you're interested in, and for the initial data also that you're interested in, actually work well. As you can see here, depending on the problem you choose, either you have this sort of fairly spiky initial data here, or you have a broad peak, depending on what initial data you're, or in other words, what specific problem you're actually interested in. Even if your method has some deficiencies, it might still be okay. But that exactly depends on what you want to sort of find out and get out of that numerical experiment.